This morning, America's First News starts right after this. Do you own or rent your home? Sure you do. Fortunately, GEICO makes it easy to bundle your home and car insurance. It's a good thing, too, because having a home is hard work. Go to GEICO.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. GEICO.com. Easy.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This morning, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Soaring numbers, milder symptoms. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Kashinka in for Gordon Deal, along with Mike Gavin on this Wednesday, December 29th. Here's what we have for you this hour.
The CDC says Omicron can lead to reinfections that are often accompanied by mild symptoms as new cases soar across the U.S.
Harry Reid of Nevada, former Democratic Senate Majority Leader, has died of cancer at the age of 82.
John Madden, a Hall of Fame football coach who went on to become a legendary broadcaster and the face of a wildly popular video game series, has died at the age of 85.
And the biggest opponent facing college football player teams, COVID.
Seems like most of these teams are pretty well protected. They all have incredibly high vaccination rates, in excess of 98%, and most of these players have been boosted. So far, so good. But as we know with Omicron, things can change very quickly.
Lane Higgins of the Wall Street Journal will be here in about 20 minutes with that story. The CDC is adding to other research suggesting the Omicron variant can lead to reinfections that are often accompanied by mild COVID symptoms as new cases soar across the U.S. States reported over 512,550 cases on Monday, the most for a single day since the start of the pandemic, as states caught up after pausing for the Christmas holiday. The CDC says Omicron now accounts for about 59% of all COVID cases, a significant decrease from the agency's estimate last week of 73%. Pediatric hospitalizations are also rising. The U.S. is averaging 260 pediatric hospitalizations a day, up nearly 30% from a week ago. Ashish Jha, dean of the School of Public Health at Brown University, spoke with ABC.
I suspect some part of the story, of course, is that a lot of kids remain unvaccinated. Under five kids are not even eligible. Of 5 to 17, a lot of parents have not yet gotten their kids vaccinated.
In New York, the number of people in the hospital in the state with COVID jumped 12% in one day. New York City Mayor-elect Eric Adams.
We're meeting a surge in the virus with a surge in resources because testing and vaccinations are how we beat COVID.
In New York State, nearly 20% of all COVID tests came back positive yesterday, and in just the last 5 days, about 1% of all residents tested positive for the virus. Former Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, who rose from a hardscrabble Nevada childhood to become a powerful Democratic force in Congress during the Obama presidency, has died after a four-year battle with pancreatic cancer at the age of 82. As the Senate's top Democrat, Reid successfully blocked President George W. Bush from privatizing Social Security and later helped enact the 2010 Affordable Care Act. He also led a push to change the Senate's procedures to confirm executive branch nominees and most judges with a simple majority. In 2012, Reid spoke at the Democratic National Convention.
I'm ready to do the difficult work that's ahead. But I want to do that work with Barack Obama and not a Tea Party ideologue.
Reid was born in 1939 in Searchlight, Nevada, to an alcoholic minor and a mother who took in laundry from brothels and car dealers at casinos. After earning a law degree at George Washington University while working as a U.S. Capitol policeman, Reid launched his political career as the attorney for a small town of Henderson. His big break came when he was elected lieutenant governor at the age of 30. Reid retired from the Senate in 2017. John Madden, a Hall of Fame football coach who retired young and went on to become a legendary broadcaster in the face of a wildly popular video game series, has died at age 85. To fans of a certain age, Madden was the coach who led the Oakland Raiders to a Super Bowl victory in the 1976 season. For millions of NFL viewers, he will be remembered as an outlandish commentator who transformed the way people watch sports. Here's Madden calling a playoff game between Philadelphia and Dallas.
That's where it escapes. If you have heat in your body and you want to let it out, you take your hat off.
Yeah.
You know, what you could do is you could have a barbecue on that head.
As head coach of the Raiders at the age of 32, Madden was football's first player's coach. His philosophy, he would later write, boiled down to three simple requirements: be on time, pay attention, and play like hell when I ask you to. After stepping away from coaching, Madden announced games on each of the four major networks during his three-decade career. He earned a record 16 Emmys as a sportscaster. To a younger generation, Madden will forever be known as the face of Electronic Arts' Madden NFL Football, one of the most popular sports video games of all time.
What are your 2022 business goals? Simplified IT? More security? Dell Technologies has the expertise to help you. From transforming your digital workspaces to providing comprehensive end-to-end IT solutions, get high-performance computers featuring Windows 11 Pro with powerful hardware-based security and savings up to 45% during Dell's New Year event sale. Get special financing through Dell Financial Services. Call a Dell Technologies advisor at 877-ASK-DELL.
Cryptocurrency is exploding, and that's forcing Washington to set some new financial rules. The story from Sylvan Lane at The Hill. Sylvan, is some regulation of crypto a bipartisan issue?
It's really interesting because, you know, despite the polarization in Washington, there's kind of a bipartisan understanding that the current federal financial rules don't really fit cryptocurrency super well, just because of the innovative ways that, you know, cryptocurrencies and other similar utilities and platforms are kind of blurring the lines that Congress and the judges set kind of almost a century ago.
Who's taking a look at what's going on right now?
So a lot of this is happening at the regulatory level with the Securities and Exchange Commission, that agency which regulates stock markets and, the investment industry broadly, has been taking a close look at cryptocurrencies to see what obligations that those who offer cryptocurrencies, allow people to trade them or sell them, what kind of rules they have to abide by. But there's also been a lot of work at the legislative level to understand how the laws might need to change to help regulatory agencies actually do that.
Sylvan, what are some of the concerns that lawmakers have about crypto?
So the primary concern that some of the lawmakers who are critical of the sector have is that because of the decentralized nature, where there's not necessarily one point where you could oversee everything, a lot of folks are concerned that this could help facilitate certain financial crimes like money laundering or make it easier for folks to avoid taxes. There's also some concerns with some of the more complicated cryptocurrency investment deals about how much investors and potential customers actually know about what's going on behind the scenes.
I was going to say, if you ask the average person about cryptocurrency, they may have heard of the term, but they don't really understand it. Is it tough for lawmakers to actually understand what they're facing too?
That's exactly right. You know, folks who advocate for the cryptocurrency industry in Washington say that their number one challenge has been just getting lawmakers to understand how these technologies work, how they're changing. It's a tough job because it's, you know, all fairly novel, and it's changing really quickly and expanding really quickly. So it's a bit of a moving target there, but lawmakers have been getting a little better of a sense of how these work and, you know, what they, as, you know, members of Congress have to do to deal with them.
We're speaking with Sylvan Lane at The Hill. Your story mentions that lawmakers and regulators in both parties have expressed some concern about stablecoins. What are stablecoins and why are they particularly concerned about them?
So unlike other cryptocurrencies, which, you know, kind of move up and down pretty rapidly, stablecoins are meant to be exactly what the name says, stable. You're supposed to be able to redeem them for a fixed amount of U.S. dollars. And, you know, the main idea behind these is that these are good ways to, you know, pay people, send people money, and even lend. Now, there's a lot of promise here, potentially, if these can be, you know, accepted and overseen in a way that Washington feels comfortable with. But there's also a lot of concern that these stablecoins may not be as actually stable as they're marketed to be. And what could happen to, you know, some of the assets that these companies hold if these stable coins start to collapse, and then they start needing to redeem them for dollars and treasury bonds, and, you know, potentially causing broader issues across financial markets.
I'm sure there are some lawmakers that are worried that too many rules will stifle what's going on. What do they say about all this?
So some of the lawmakers who are most excited about cryptocurrencies compare this moment to when the internet was really starting to become popular and prominent in the early 90s. And they're very concerned that if Washington goes too far, it could stamp out a lot of ways that cryptocurrencies could potentially expand the ways and the options for people to send money, make money, invest money, and do a lot of things that may not necessarily be super easy through the financial system as we know it right now. So they've been really, really urging to strike a balance between, you know, investor and customer protection and making sure these companies aren't stifled in ways that they can't grow and expand.
Thanks, Sylvan. Sylvan Lane at the Hill. It's 19 minutes past the hour. Here's Mike Gavin.
And now, the three big things you need to know. Number one.
The seven-day average of new COVID-19 cases in the U.S. broke a new record, topping 267,000, according to a New York Times tally, with the eastern half of the country hit especially hard. Meanwhile, New York City will stop quarantining entire classrooms exposed to the virus and will instead prioritize a ramped-up testing program so that asymptomatic students testing negative for COVID-19 can remain in school. Mayor Bill de Blasio.
Right now, we do PCR testing in every school every week. We're going to double the amount of testing we do in schools.
The number of people in the hospital in New York State with COVID-19 rose 12% in one day.
Number two.
Another 4,800 U.S. flights were delayed and over 1,100 flights were canceled yesterday because of a mix of COVID-19 and weather-related problems, according to the flight tracking website FlightAware. Globally, airlines canceled more than 6,000 flights on Christmas Eve, Christmas, and the day after Christmas.
Number three.
A hotel clerk gravely wounded in the Denver area shooting spree died on Tuesday, bringing to five the number of people killed in Monday night's rampage by a gunman. Police identified the gunman as 47-year-old Lyndon James McLeod. Lakewood Public Information Officer John Romero praised an officer who was able to fatally shoot the gunman despite being wounded herself.
In the face of being shot, in the face of danger, she was able to not only save others from this terrible tragedy, but also neutralize the threat.
Police did not offer a possible motive and provided few details about McLeod, except to say that all of the dead but one, the hotel clerk, were known to him. With 4 days left to go in the month, Lake Tahoe has already broken the record for December snowfall set 50 years ago. On Monday, December snow totals at the UC Berkeley Central Sierra Snow Lab reached 193.7 inches, blowing a 1970 record of 179 inches out of the water. And here's a way to get your fast food fix guilt-free. McDonald's in China has confirmed that the company is testing in-store exercise bikes at its restaurants. Footage emerged recently on social media showing a woman sitting on a stationary bike while eating a hamburger at McDonald's, and the company confirmed the bikes have been installed as seats at two Chinese locations. McDonald's cited two goals for the bikes: one, to help customers stay healthy while eating fast food, and two, to promote sustainability, since the bikes can generate electricity that customers can use to charge up their cell phones and other devices.
Kind of a neat idea. However, exercising and eating at the same time
Yes.
doesn't sound like a good idea.
The idea of scarfing down a Big Mac while pedaling a bike, Yeah. That makes my stomach feel a little queasy just thinking about it.
Yeah, me too. Thanks, Mike.
If you've been back at the office lately, have you noticed how work attire has changed? The days of stuffy, uncomfortable clothes is gone, thankfully. And for the new wardrobe, Cuts Clothing is on the cutting edge of casual. They've elevated the classic t-shirt to something that fits the workday, the nightlife, and you perfectly. I know firsthand, I love my Cuts shirts. They're flexible, willing to move with me, and they're tough. Perfect for when I'm in the office or a night out. Get them for yourself now, and you'll not only look good at this year's holiday events, you'll look good and stay comfortable. There's something for everyone on my list and yours, not just t-shirts. There's polos, bomber jackets, joggers, and more. Get them all from Cuts Clothing now, and don't just save time, save money too. Cuts has your holiday shopping covered with a ton of new products and special site-exclusive offers every day in December. Plus, get 15% off site-wide at cutsclothing.com/Gordon. That's C-U-T-S, cutsclothing.com/Gordon to get 15% off. Plus, can't miss daily deals. cutsclothing.com/Gordon.
There's a new opponent in the college football playoff picture, Omicron. Before the four playoff teams, Alabama, Cincinnati, Georgia, and Michigan, take the field on Friday, they have to have as many healthy players as possible. Lane Higgins of the Wall Street Journal has taken a close look at this situation and joins us now. Lane, what's the latest on player availability?
It's a little bit unclear. Georgia looks like they've had a few positive cases, but the players that we think tested positive earlier in the week, that's sometimes starting quarterback JT Daniels and wide receiver George Pickens, joined the team in Miami. They came down a little bit later than the rest of the team, but it's still unclear if they will play. And, you know, it seems like most of these teams are pretty well protected. They all have incredibly high vaccination rates, in excess of 98%, and most of these players have been boosted. So far, so good. But as we know with Omicron, things can change very quickly.
Lane, you've got Alabama, Cincinnati, Georgia, and Michigan. What different or similar approaches did they take regarding sending players home for Christmas?
So Michigan was probably the strictest of the bunch in that they kept players in Ann Arbor and said, you know what, we're not going to risk it. We want you to stay here. Eliminate one piece of travel. But the rest of the programs allowed players to go home. You know, that's something that Alabama did last year with great success, despite the fact that there weren't vaccines as a way to mitigate COVID risk. And, you know, famously, they went on to win it all. So clearly they didn't have too many issues with outbreaks. And Georgia took a similar approach in letting kids go home to their parents if they were close by. And Cincinnati did as well. So what's interesting is that none of these programs are requiring the athletes to be tested before rejoining the program. So in theory, that does open them up to a little more risk. But, you know, the way college football has been testing all year is that you only get you only are singled out for a COVID test if you're symptomatic. So it's possible that these teams have asymptomatic cases going around right now and they just don't know. But, you know, given the NFL's guidance of following the same thing, it's likely that it's possible that asymptomatically positive players could continue on and play on Friday in the playoffs.
We're speaking with Lane Higgins of the Wall Street Journal. There have been some bowl games canceled. There have been some scrambling of putting other teams in other places. I would think for the playoff, though, they would do just about anything to keep these two games on track.
Yes, and the College Football Playoff Committee came out with some specific rules for how it's going to handle this. If, you know, one of these teams can't play, then they forfeit and the opponent advances. And, you know, there's certain contingencies where if three of the teams can't field enough players, then the national champion is just automatically whatever team is left standing. But there is a window in which they would, I think, try to reschedule some of these games. It's less important to the college football playoff based on these rules to reschedule the semifinals. It's far more important to reschedule the final because I think that, you know, you might be able, through forfeiting, to get a team to advance on to the final round, but, you know, they're going to move heaven and earth to try to have a final championship game, whether that's on, you know, January 10th as currently planned, or I think it can happen as late as January 14th.
And Lane, in a very worst-case scenario, if a team starts to really get hit by COVID or flu and start losing players, is it up to that school to decide what is a safe number to go forward?
Yes, so that's another kind of crazy thing is last year, because of, you know, just how rampant COVID was and how few tools we had to mitigate it, a lot of these schools said, you know, there's a minimum of about 56, I think, or 60 players that you need to have, scholarship players out of the 85 total on a roster to go forward and play. But that's actually not the case this year. But I think, you know, as you've seen in the NFL, the issue is not necessarily the total number of players that you have out, it's what position group. So hypothetically, if all of your defensive linemen get COVID, you could only have, you know, a handful of players that are out, but it would be really hard to go ahead and play football in any sort of safe and effective way if you have a position group that's just decimated like that. So, you know, because of that, it's up to the teams to make the call on, you know, what the go, no-go point is.
Lane Higgins of the Wall Street Journal. Last night, UCLA bowed out of its game against NC State in the Holiday Bowl. It's coming up on 30 minutes past the hour on This Morning, America's First News.
We don't go online the way we used to. These days, we have instant access for everything from photos to our finances right on our devices. We're almost always connected. And without the right online protection, you're almost always vulnerable to hackers. That's why there's Aura. Aura is a new type of security service that protects all of your online information and devices with one simple subscription. It's all-in-one protection from identity theft, financial fraud, malware, scam sites, and so much more. Aura provides digital security protection to keep your online finances, personal information, and tech safe from online threats with an easy online dashboard and alerts sent straight to your phone. Aura is easy to set up, and all plans come with $1 million in identity theft insurance to help recover your stolen funds and experienced U.S.-based customer support that's got your back. And for a limited time, Aura is offering our listeners up to 40% off plans when you visit aura.com/Gordon. Go to aura.com/Gordon to get complete protection and savings of up to 40%. That's A-U-R-A, aura.com/Gordon.
The news, first, fast, and free of noise. You're listening to America's First News, This Morning with Gordon Deal.
On this Wednesday, December 29th, Jennifer Kishinka in for Gordon Deal, along with Mike Gavin. Some of our top stories and headlines. The U.S. hits a record average of daily new COVID cases. Legendary NFL broadcaster and Super Bowl winning coach John Madden has died. President Biden has rescinded travel restrictions on African countries imposed due to Omicron. Former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo will not face criminal charges in Westchester County. And it's the end of the road for a Pennsylvania church that opened in 1800. That story in about 20 minutes. Amidst a labor shortage, what's attracting employees to small businesses? Here with some insight is John Waldman, CEO of Homebase. John, according to your company's recent survey about this, where does salary rank?
One of the surprises, I think, given the headlines, was that pay was the number two factor.
Why do you think that was not primary number one?
Well, I think for all of the headlines, and certainly inflation is real, certainly the labor shortage is real, and if anything, that has made pay move up the rankings. But the reality is, at the end of the day, what people care most about is the work experience. That was true pre-COVID.
What are some of the other things that employees are looking for?
You know, there are some of these things that are especially important if you are a business with hourly employees, like the small businesses we support, restaurant, retail, dog groomers, optometrists, you know, folks that are working in shift-based businesses. In that environment, a lot of what matters comes down to the schedule itself, flexible work hours, a predictable work schedule, things that help workers manage their life a little bit more. But for all environments, you know, the number one thing is company leadership. The number three thing, it's great coworkers. So again, it comes down to that work experience that people are going to work every day and feeling.
What can you find out about company leadership before you accept a job somewhere? Do you just do research or is it talking to people?
Certainly, I would recommend doing those things. You know, in some places, there are things like Glassdoor and Yelp and other places where you can get a view into the company to get a little bit of a better sense for what is it like working there. But, you know, a lot of it comes down to that feeling you get during the interviews where that business is, you get the opportunity to interview them as much as they're interviewing you. And if you are a manager, you shouldn't kid yourself. That's what's happening right now.
John, there are a lot of surveys that show us that some kind of a career advancement is extremely important to people. They want to know that they have a room to move up. Is that what you found in your survey?
Yeah. Learning and development opportunities did hit the top 10. That was 7 in the ranking. And it is something that's really important. But, you know, I think it's really tied to the company leadership, too. I think that is one of those things that is coming under the umbrella of the company culture and the company leadership.
We're speaking with John Waldman, CEO of Homebase. Another thing on the list that seems to be moving up every year is the company's commitment to sustainability and the environment. We've been seeing that young people find this especially important.
Yeah, I think what you are seeing is that you should expect this to be moving up as the demographics of the workforce change. This is very clearly something that a lot of workers care about now. And I think another thing that workers are seeing is that in this past year, there are clear connections to the decisions that a business makes and the larger footprint on a community or on the world at large.
You mentioned earlier the flexibility aspect. What about commuting and working from home? Are people still insisting on that, and will they in the future now that we've been doing it?
Certainly, this has been a hot topic, and it is something that every business really probably should have an answer on. But here's the other reality. The other reality is that for 2/3 of the workforce, they've never worked at home, and it's not going to be an option. You know, for as much as work from home is a topic of discussion, we should also remember that for most workers in this country, their work involves being someplace in person. And so when we talk about flexibility in that environment, what really matters is things like scheduling, access to pay, predictability, all of those other things.
Thanks, John. John Waldman, CEO of Homebase. Coming up, how Van Gogh became one of entertainment world's biggest stars this year.
What are your 2022 business goals? Simplified IT, more security? Dell Technologies has the expertise to help you. From transforming your digital workspaces to providing comprehensive end-to-end IT solutions, get high-performance computers featuring Windows 11 Pro with powerful hardware-based security and savings up to 45% during Dell's New Year event sale. Get special financing through Dell Financial Services. Call a Dell Technologies advisor at 877-ASK-DELL.
Jennifer Koshinka in for Gordon Deal along with Mike Gavin on this holiday week. The star of the 2021 Entertainment World, an immersive Van Gogh exhibit. Market Watch's Charles Passy has more on this novel way to experience art and joins us now. Charles, explain what this exhibit is exactly.
Well, this is not your traditional museum exhibit. I mean, there are dozens of these that are being presented across the U.S., across North America, across the world. What you really have to think of it is imagine that there were, you know, essentially photographic images of the works, you know, essentially reproductions of the works or just photos of the works that are projected in these cavernous venues. I mean, we're talking, you know, venues that normally house conventions. So the art is just kind of surrounding you. They are essentially immersive exhibits. In some cases, the works kind of come to life. I don't want to make it seem like it's like, you know, bad animation, but, you know, you do see the paintings kind of move in some instances, and they've become quite a sensation. I mean, we're talking millions of tickets sold for these exhibits.
They're bringing in millions, but does it cost a lot to set them up?
No, actually, I mean, one of the reasons that I think promoters have really seized upon this idea is that, I mean, relatively speaking, they're not expensive. First of all, Van Gogh's works are in the public domain, so you don't have to pay any licensing fees to essentially create one of these events. The cost, you know, one promoter I spoke to said, costs about $250,000 to set up the exhibit, to set up the images or whatever, to create the movie, if you will. And then there's probably an expense anywhere between $50,000 to $75,000 in each venue you set up to secure the venue, to essentially, you know, set up the projectors. Obviously, there are going to be ongoing staffing costs as well. But, you know, keep in mind, once you invest that initial $250,000, it's like a movie. You can run this anywhere you want across the world or whatever. You know, you have to, obviously, in each venue, you're going to have to pay some setup costs, like I say, $50,000 to $75,000. But as things go, you know many hit movies that have been created for $250,000? This is a cheap deal for them, basically.
Charles, is this immersive art exhibit idea a new one? Has this been around at all?
You know, certainly with the Van Gogh ones, you're talking about this goes back about a decade. The idea, this also sort of falls into the realm of digital art, which is an emerging field. So, you know, we're talking probably there, you know, going back a generation at most, but it's becoming hotter and hotter and hotter, and very much a counterpoint to the museum world. So this is kind of getting away from the idea of pictures in a gallery, which has been kind of how we've experienced art for, you know, centuries, really, now at this point. This is about, you know, using non-traditional spaces and creating art that essentially lives and breathes on the walls.
We're speaking with Charles Passy of Market Watch. Charles, do these exhibits bring out people who normally would not go to museums and say museums are boring or dull? Does this appeal to kids or a different kind of art person?
Absolutely. What is clear from talking to promoters is that this has a very wide audience. It does include traditional museum goers, which actually surprised me. But I would say that the target market is the non-traditional museum goer. And in fact, the gentleman, Bruce Pedersen, an Australian exhibition promoter, who is often credited with being kind of the first in this field, he started doing these Van Gogh things, like I say, about a decade ago was the earliest. He was at the fore of this. He said the idea for this occurred to him after taking his kids, who I assume were much younger then, about 15 years ago, his kids to museums in France and Italy. You know, he thought he'd show them the great art of the world and the great museums of the world, and the kids kept asking for ice cream or gelato, as he said. So you know, he realized that his kids were not engaged, and he said, there's got to be a different way. Well, this became the different way.
Charles, will the immersive exhibits force traditional museums to display things differently?
That remains to be seen. There does appear to be a lot of resistance to this in the museum world. However, there is one noteworthy example. Newfields, which is essentially an exhibition space, a park, a garden that incorporates the Indianapolis Museum of Art. It's in Indianapolis. It has devoted an entire gallery space, if you will, a very large gallery space to digital art, immersive digital art experiences. And, of course, naturally, it has a Van Gogh show up right now.
Thanks, Charles. Charles Passy of MarketWatch. It's 9 minutes before the hour. Here is Mike Gavin.
And now, the three big things you need to know. Number one.
COVID-19 cases driven by the Omicron variant continue to spike, setting records across the country and driving hospitalizations up in states like Louisiana, Florida, New Jersey, and New York, where Governor Kathy Hochul warns that a spike in kids in the hospital with COVID means that vaccinations are more urgent than ever.
It is affecting children more, but the ones who are getting severely sick are so far only the unvaccinated children. So that should be the message you need to know right now.
Number two.
Former Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, who rose from a hardscrabble Nevada childhood to become a powerful Democratic force in Congress during the Obama presidency, has died. He was 82 after a four-year battle with pancreatic cancer. As the Senate's top Democrat, Reid successfully blocked President George W. Bush from privatizing Social Security and later helped enact the 2010 health insurance law known as the Affordable Care Act.
Number three.
NFL fans are paying tribute to John Madden, the longtime NFL coach and broadcaster who died at the age of 85. After a very successful 10-year stint coaching the Oakland Raiders, Madden transitioned to the booth in 1979, becoming the signature voice of the NFL for 30 years, captivating fans with his love of the game and his ability to find other ways to entertain, like in this clip about a blimp flying above the stadium.
See, that's a tethered blimp. You shouldn't know words like tethered. That thing moves by itself. There's no man up there in that blimp. That just moves. When you say move, stop, it does.
A county prosecutor says that former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo won't face criminal charges stemming from allegations of unwanted kissing by two women, one of them a state trooper assigned to his detail. Westchester County District Attorney Mimi Rocha said that while there was evidence to conclude the conduct the women described did occur, the office couldn't pursue criminal charges, quote, due to the statutory requirements of the criminal laws of New York. And if 2021 has sent your mood to a darker place, we may have just the house for you. A real estate listing in Illinois went viral due to the home's unique look. Not only does it have an unusual shape, the most recent owner chose a paint color that really stands out, black, all black. The all-black octagon-shaped home has been dubbed the Goth House on social media. The home's owner told Fox News that he didn't originally set out to go dark with the paint scheme, but after first making the roof black, he followed up with the exterior and then just decided to make the whole thing match. So far, he says there's been a lot of interest in the house, which was listed for $250,000, but he's yet to receive any serious offers.
This seems like something that should have come up earlier.
What's
like,
that?
Black houses. Like,
that's never happened before?
Yeah.
Well, I guess when you're, you know, trying to sell your house, a real estate agent probably wouldn't tell you to do that,
yeah,
right?
But people probably make some really weird colors choices, too.
Yeah, I mean, black, you know, it's not exactly a neutral color, or the kind of color that everybody wants to buy.
This is true.
You know what I mean? But $250,000, though, I might look into it. That's pretty good these days for
move.
A house.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Mike. Coming up, the end of a very long era at a Pennsylvania church.
Do you own or rent your home? Sure you do. Fortunately, Geico makes it easy to bundle your home and car insurance. It's a good thing, too, because having a home is hard work. Go to geico.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. Geico.com. Easy.
The doors are closing for good at a Pennsylvania church with a 221-year history. The First Presbyterian Church of Bellefonte, which is nearly as old as the borough itself, held its final scheduled service on Christmas Eve after having welcomed generations of families over the course of more than two centuries. It's closing because of declining membership and attendance. The church was established in 1800 by the same men who founded Bellefonte in 1795 at a time when there were only 16 states and counted among its members two former Pennsylvania governors. The church met at the courthouse for almost two decades and then in a stone edifice. The current structure was built shortly after the Civil War. The church had about 40 members before the pandemic, a number that's down to 25. 2025, it had no in-person worship from March 2020 until Easter Sunday. The 15,000-square-foot church is scheduled to close for the last time on Friday. The future of the building has not been determined. That'll do it for this hour. For Mike Gavin, I'm Jennifer Kishinka. Thanks for listening to This Morning, America's First News.